there will now be what's called a moderated open panel debate. Now, we did start late, and I'm going to factor that in because I do want the maximum amount of time given to you, the audience, to make your points, ask your questions, and make your comments. So I'm going to reduce the moderated panel debate to about 45 minutes, and that will give you also about 45 minutes to ask your questions and so forth. I'd like to go to my left, so to speak, and invite one of the speakers here, perhaps Jeffrey, to make comments, and then basically the panelists feel free to come in a respectful and gentlemanly way and have a discourse, if you like, about this evening's subject. So, Jeffrey, if you want to say something.
Yes, I haven't really prepared anything for this part. I'd just like to clear up a factual inaccuracy, if that's all right. Robin Tilbrook said that Nick Griffin was trying to raise money for the BNP from Colonel Gaddafi, and it was rather recently. It was actually 25 years ago. Nick Griffin was in the National Front at the time, not the BNP, and it was long before fundamentalism had made any kind of appearance in this country, so I think conditions were rather different then. I realise that's somewhat off topic, but I felt it needed correcting. Can I keep my comment short?
Yes, please do.
Andrew Copson made a comment about the decline in racism, which accompanied the increase in immigration. I'm not sure how you would measure decline in racism. I think what we've seen an increase of is an increase in thought crime legislation, which sort of determines what people can and can't say. And given that people are so constrained by the law these days, then probably they're less inclined to express racist sentiments than they would have been in the past.
I mean, it is measured, of course, in polls and surveys such as British Social Attitudes and so on and so forth, and it's often measured by saying, for example, who you'd be happy to have as a neighbour, who you'd be comfortable with in social environments. So that's how it's measured, and that's how the decline in racism over the last 50 years is evidenced. And it is clearly evidenced.
A lot of people now feel it's against the law to express such sentiments, so they'd be disinclined perhaps to say what they mean in some cases.
Well, that doesn't mean that you can sort of make it up and say that that's what they really mean.
Abdullah, do you want to come in?
Yeah, actually a number of points I wanted to respond to Jeffrey about.
Can we just keep to a couple of points rather than lots of points?
Sure. One of those points was that anecdotal evidence, some Muslims attacked some English people somewhere in the UK, and this is proof of Islamification. I could give you 10 times the number of reports of Muslims getting packy-bashed by thugs. Some of them are pro-BNP thugs. Can I use this and say, oh, are all English people are violent because a few thugs went and attacked? And I must say the statistics are that more Muslims suffer from racism and attacks than non-Muslims. So, I mean, how would you answer that one, Jeffrey?
My point would not be that Muslims are intrinsically violent, and that wasn't the point I was trying to make. And I wasn't trying to say that in the country overall, that the country is being Islamified, but I would say that certain areas are. Tower Hamlets, I took, was just one example. There are parts of Oldham, Bradford, Leeds, Newham, where you have the same kind of situation. And in these communities, which are often quite poor, where people actually don't have the opportunity of leaving quite so easily, as perhaps Alan was suggesting, people do suffer if they're not part of the dominant group. The dominant group has become Muslim. There's a feeling that they can't go into the local park because, you know, that's their space. They can't walk down our street, you know, because that's the Muslim space. People do feel that those areas are becoming Islamified, but I'm aware that if you go out to Henley-on-Thames or something, you know, Boris Johnson's constituency, you wouldn't see too many Muslims or have too much trouble.
It's like saying, like, Stamford Hill is being... Judaified because it has, you know, a Jewish majority of Jewish population, or that Lambeth is being Afro-Caribbeanized because there's a black population, and so on. When the immigrants get here, they get put into certain sections. It's not that it's actually just an erroneous topic to say they're being Islamified because we're talking about the British society, and of course you're going to get neighborhoods which are predominantly one or the other, and over time they might disperse and as they're being absorbed into the population. But every time immigrants have ever come to England, for example, East London, where you have all the Bangladeshis, before they were owned by the Jews during the 1920s and so on. And Maybe we should have had a debate back then. Said, is England being Judified?
And the, so there on. Was
I'm
a
sure
debate.
I'm sure
it'd
be much more in sync with the debate going on in Germany at that time.
Well, the Aliens Registry, the Aliens Act, was put forward in 1905 because of the strange effect on people of Polish and Russian Jews who were appearing at that time. So there was a debate back then. There were many debates. So you know what we're doing now is nothing new.
Alan, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I live in Newham, and you've mentioned a few times about Newham. I live in a Muslim-majority area, as I say. It's actually an interesting place to live in, and I embrace living in there. And there are some very hilarious and not-so-hilarious situations. If I said to you the largest and most vital of the mosques, and there are many around our way, shares a wall with an off-licence, with a large off-licence Buy Your Beer Here notice sticking out, they're sharing the wall, and run by Bangladeshis, you realise actually this is a society that's actually, it isn't black and white, it isn't set in aspic as seems to be argued on my left, but actually there's a lot of variety. There's a very popular halal restaurant right by the bus stop where I get the bus down there, and last February they were running a Valentine's dinner dance down there. Well, some Valentine's dinner dance, a very English or probably American concept, but they're running it in this Muslim restaurant. Life is not all black and white. There are mixtures going on. And for those of us that enjoy the diversity and enjoy living in that sort of thing, there was no threat in it. There was no. It is a changing environment in which it's a good place to live. I embrace it. That doesn't stop me, however, saying there are aspects of Islam and there's aspects of Hinduism and aspects of all sorts of things. I'd like to have a go at the humanist in a minute, if it fits within the debate tonight. There are aspects which we want to debate. And that's why these functions like this are very good. But let's not get it wrong. Newham is a good place to live because of its diversity, and I'm proud of the fact that London opens its doors to many people, and from right where around the globe. That is, as I understand it, God's world has come to London.
Father Frank?
2 points. In response to what Andrew just said about the virtues of liberal democracy, I would like to remind ourselves of the fact that since 9/11, we have had two aggressive wars unleashed against two Muslim countries in the name of liberal democracy. The old cliche that democracies do not start wars, it is dictatorships or totalitarian states which do, is no longer valid. Certainly the Iraqi war, by now I think very few people would deny that it was illegal, it was not authorized by a second Security Council resolution. Even the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, I think it was, said that regime change would have been not a legal basis to start a war. In fact, that's what happened. We were lied to by Bush and Blair about the weapons of mass destruction, blah, blah, blah. So, and we know what has happened to Iraq after the invasion. The country has been martyred. And even now it goes on. As far as Afghanistan is concerned, I would like to say, first of all, that I do support the British Army in Afghanistan. They are serving the country with their duty. I do not, though, believe that the war is necessary. I think it is unjustified. I think the war leads nowhere. It is a futile and stupid war. It cannot be won. And indeed, even the much maligned Taliban, after 9/11, when the Yanks had given the ultimatum, you've got to give us Bin Laden, have moved towards, they called a meeting of Islamic specialists, and they had concluded, well, we can't give up Bin Laden to infidels, that contradicts our values, and the Pashtun Valley incidentally says, you cannot give up a host, but we'll ask him to leave. So Bin Laden could have, Al-Qaeda could have been got out of Afghanistan, but the decision had already been made, the Bush and Blair to invade. So both wars, conducted in the name of liberal democracy, sanctioned by the British Parliament in this case, were unjust wars. So quite clear, not everything is so hunky-dory about liberal democracy. Second point, minor point about...
Sorry, Frank, can Andrew just come in on that? I just want to politely remind...
Sorry, can I make a very brief point? The only brief point I want to make about Jeffrey, the very painful case of a clergyman who was attacked, and that is, of course, absolutely awful. But I remember when I was training for a presto in East Oxford, which is the more immigrant-based part of Oxford, Father Martin Flatman, a lovely Anglo-Catholic priest, told me, you know, in this area I get spat upon sometimes. In fact, the only people who are nice to me are the Muslims. He said that. I shall always remember that.
Thanks, Frank. I'd just like to politely remind the speakers that the debate this evening is the Islamification of Britain, reality or myth, as much as I value your comments, Father Frank. Would Andrew like to respond nonetheless to another issue?
Well, I mean, I don't want to, nothing really that much to respond to. I didn't say that liberal democracies don't go to war or that they don't start wars. I simply recommended the liberal democratic framework as a framework for living together in a shared society. However, I think it is worth pointing out that when liberal democracy is maligned in that way, speakers very often on the one hand say liberal democracies do this, and then on the other hand to say what is good as counterpose this liberal democracy, they then bring out the institutions of liberal democracy like attorney generals and international law and public protest and inquiry and so on. And so I think that the... You know, life is imperfect, and there are two sides to every system of organising ourselves.
Robin, would you like to say something?
Listening to what's being said, I've got some doubt, really, as to whether we actually live in a liberal democracy. And if you think about, for instance, the government that we've got at the moment, this has got a historically large majority. It's got a majority that can rewrite the constitution at will, and 21% of the electorate voted for it. What kind of liberal democracy is that? And I think I would like to come back about the point about Nick Griffin, because actually it's not 25 years ago. Any of you who want to check it out can actually go onto YouTube. And there's a YouTube of him being interviewed explaining why he'd gone to see Colonel Gaddafi to raise money.
How many years ago was it then? How many years ago was it? When did it take place? Do you know which year?
About 15 years ago.
1986, nearly 25 years ago.
I'd like to ask the BNP representative a question of my own. If your party came to power in this country, would you guarantee the rights of the Muslim citizens of this country to worship freely or not?
As to my knowledge, we have no plans to take away anybody's religious freedom. It's a great tradition of this country that people should have religious freedom.
So is that a yes to a guarantee?
That is a yes.
Okay, thank you. Alan, you wanted to say a word?
Yes, I want to come back onto the issue of Sharia, if I may, and I want to attempt to take Abdullah to task. He won't mind. He and I have debated a number of times on television elsewhere, so I'll do so. But he has said something tonight, which he does say and others say, about Sharia law, which I don't think is the full story. You'll have heard Abdullah say that Sharia law, they're not really trying to promote or Sharia law in this country. Well, some Muslims are, and there's some Anglican archbishops who seem to think it's a good idea. I'd like to argue with them. But I actually want to challenge Abdullah on this thing, that, Sharia law is okay for Muslim societies, but not for, we're not trying to push it into the UK. Paul told you earlier that he became a Muslim. It would be mainstream Muslim thought to tell you that he didn't convert to Islam, he reverted to Islam. Now, he'd never been, as far as I know, he'd never been a Muslim before in his life, but they would tell you he reverted to Islam, went back to Islam. Now, the heart of Islam theology is a something called fitra, that everything in the whole universe is Islamic. And therefore, actually, everything in England fundamentally is Islamic. It's part of the DNA. You and I actually are Islamic. In religious terms, Jesus, if you want to go there, Jesus and Moses and Abraham and Adam were all Muslims. They didn't know it, but that is Islamic theology. If that is the case, and I think it is, Abdullah is not telling you the full story, is he, when he says that he's not interested in England becoming a subject to Sharia law? He must, as a Muslim, believe that England must become Islamic if it's going to get back to its natural state. It reverts to Islam. And if that is the case, he must actually be saying one day, perhaps not this year, 2009, one day he, as a Muslim, will want Britain to be an Islamic state and therefore all people to be under Sharia law. So I'd like to ask Abdullah if he was telling us the full story, because I don't think he was. Okay.
Well, yeah, me and Alan Craig are old debating buddies and so on, as you can probably guess. Just to go straight to his points, firstly, I don't think he understands what the word fitra means. It means human nature. We basically believe that Sharia is made for human nature, for human beings. So every human being has the innate propensity to accept the Sharia and agree with it, with the human fundamental tendencies. Every ideology on the face of this planet, or every belief system, what have you, always addresses the first conception of human nature. Before you discuss anything else, you must define what human nature is, and then how do we address it? So in Islam, our concept is fitra. It's simple. He says, why is it that if we believe Sharia is the best system, that we're only wanting it for the Muslim world? Well, that's because the Muslim world is without Sharia. And to rebut to Andrew's point before, the Muslim world is ruled over by secular dictatorships. Dictatorships that would probably imprison me, for example, for being an extremist. And they would torture people like myself and even kill people like myself, and all done at the behest of certain governments in the West, like in Washington and number 10 Downing Street, which are the friend, and they're calling them friends on the war on terror, allies on the war on terror, despots and dictators who help suppress Islam. Islam so bad that they're going to validate oppression of it. But I want to respond to a few of Alan Craig's points. He keeps on harping on that Islam is oppressive to women. And I'm going to get to that. But I think with Alan Craig, I think he's confused. You see, my colleague Father Frank, I've read a lot of his literature. His basis is biblical, it is Christian. And of course, my other colleague on the left, it is liberalism and secularism, obviously, and humanism. But with Alan Craig, it's liberalism and Christianity. And when it suits him, he'll be a Christian. And when it suits him, he'll be a liberal. Let's apply liberalism on his own faith. Let's see what we get. In 1 Timothy 2, it says, verse 11, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man. She must be silent, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived, it was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved by childbirth. So that's all right.
I'm giving you a lot of latitude here because you're the only Muslim speaker on this. It is not on topic, but sure. I'm giving you a little bit of latitude because you're the only Muslim.
Can we debate it? Sure. We'd love to debate Christian.
Because this is not the subject of this evening, although it's absolutely entertaining.
Sure, all right. All right. It's about the criteria of judging the issue of Islamification of Sharia. How do you judge it? Do you judge it according to the liberal yardstick? Do you judge it according to the Christian yardstick? Do you judge it according to the fascist yardstick and so on? There are different criteria, and I'm arguing that for Alan Craig, that he should be consistent. Either he's Christian or he's liberal. And once you've chosen a position, then we can debate further.
Can I come back on that?
Briefly.
Okay. I'm saying quite simply that in Britain today, we treat men and women equally before the law. They are equal, of equal worth. That is what we do. It doesn't always work out like that. Of course it doesn't. But in law, that is the British ideal. That is part of our built-in values in Britain in the 21st century. And therefore, Sharia law is completely inappropriate to that because it does not treat women the same as men. That is what I'm saying. I'm very happy to debate Christianity and the treatment of women within the church, but it didn't seem to me to be the topic for tonight.
Indeed. No. Just very briefly.
Okay. Firstly, I don't think it's been substantiated that Islam does treat women unequally. You provide me a definition of equality and provide me a definition of human nature, men, women. So, you know what? I had a debate with the atheist Dan Barker on the same issue, and he said to me that Islam is sexist. And I said, because the men and women are given different things. And I said that nature is sexist, because why is it the man can't reproduce? Why is it the man is given more testosterone and stronger and bigger? Why is this? In nature, maybe we should complain to nature. Maybe it's nature's fault. What Islam says is not that one is better than the other. It just says that both of them have different specializations, and you know, and each can cooperate for the better good of human reproduction and society. What's wrong with this?
Okay, I'm going to move on. I would, however, like to. Indeed, we'll come back to that. I want to ask Alan a question of my own, as genuine plea for clarification. You say very clearly that you're in favour of liberty and diversity, and you spoke very eloquently about your experiences in your home borough, and I certainly respect that. But how is that to be reconciled with your advocacy of banning the burqa? Because it seems to me that there's I don't understand how you can affirm freedom and then deny the right of pious Muslim sisters to dress as they please according to their faith.
Can I just define terms? Let's be clear about this. The only aspect of Islamic dress that I'm objecting to is the face veil. I want to be clear about that because I'm not including the hijab or any other aspect at all. I find aspects of Islamic dress really quite attractive personally, of all sorts. So that's not an issue. And same with African dress and so on. I live in a multicultural one, I find that attractive. But, and this is the important part, the face veil is a statement to people, it's a very passive statement, it's a barrier between, it's a deliberate barrier, and it basically says, I do not want you to be in relationship with me, I do not want to be in relationship with you, therefore, that's what it says, and that's why I object to it. Now, how can a society say that it wants to ban something in the name of freedom? Well, freedom isn't absolute. I hate to tell you, but you're not allowed to undress completely in here. None of you are. I expect if I do, you'd be quite glad that I'm not allowed to choose to be completely free and get undressed. Our society has got rules about that, and it says you're not allowed to sit here completely undressed, completely naked. So we acknowledge that our society has rules and regulations. I'm not actually allowed to drive on the right-hand side. It's basic to a society. So our society can say, wear whatever you clothes you like, but, Alan Craig, you cannot strip off naked in public, okay? And it can say to other people, wear whatever clothes you like, but you cannot wear this deliberately anti-social piece of clothing, the face veil. You can do anything else you like. And that's what I mean by freedom.
During the Q&A, I will certainly invite questions from sisters who wear niqab or hijab or whatever to make comments from the floor. But not at the moment, sister, because this is a discussion at the panel. So, Andrew, you wanted to ask Abdullah a question, I think.
Well, is this working? Yeah. I was just wondering if Abdullah was going to answer Alan's question about whether he wouldn't prefer at some point if Britain would be under some sort of Sharia law, because he didn't answer it.
I'll make it clear. Basically, I believe that Sharia law is a system that is more consistent with human nature in dealing addressing human nature. So as you believe that liberalism is also the best system for mankind, and a communist would believe communism is the best system for mankind. So if we're asked, wouldn't you like to see all mankind under this system? I said, well, obviously, we'd all of us say the same, because if we didn't, then we don't believe in our own system. And that's what everyone answers. But suddenly, it's really bad for a Muslim to say that. Oh, you're being intolerant. You can't. Well, I can argue that liberals are intolerant. You're so intolerant, you don't even let our own countries go rule under Sharia. You support dictators. You'll do anything to torture and kill Muslims. Just under Islam.
I think it was a yes, but I mean, it's certainly not the case to say, for example, that liberalism somehow forces itself on people. It's a very clear part of a liberal approach to life in a shared society, that people have the freedom to pursue their own religions and non-religious beliefs and to govern themselves as long as they don't harm others in whatever way they wish. So I think it's not a fair attack to say that liberalism is somehow comparable to another system of law that imposes itself on people in that way.
Well, tell that to the American Marines that have come to liberate Iraq for freedom and democracy under bombs.
Well,
I won't,
because that's got nothing to do with it. I'm talking about liberalism as a way of living together in a shared society.
I have a question for Father Frank, if you don't mind. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, said in that rather long and unintelligible speech about Sharia law, can you clarify in very simple words what he was getting at and what you think he was getting at, and how do you evaluate that?
The Archbishop of Canterbury is not, although I do admire his
piety, spirituality, is not a man whom I would like normally to be interpreted, want to interpret, because, again, he's so dense. I actually defended him, which doesn't often happen, because we are, in a way, at the opposite ends of the theological spectrum. He's a liberal Catholic, I'm a conservative Anglo-Catholic. But on that particular occasion, I was actually at the time living in the Middle East. I was in the Gulf, in Qatar, in Doha. I was interviewed by Al Jazeera, and I defended the Archbishop. What he was trying to say was that the law, in a way, must reflect the developments in society, and insofar as Britain is, to some extent, affected, or they are an important Muslim minority, some of those the values of a minority should be reflected in the law. Now, this is not, I mean, I should be an apologist for Sharia, but, and I would like to say that I understand, I have no problem in accepting, recognizing the Islamic position, because Islam has a superiority complex. There is no question about that. It believes itself to be final revelation. But Christianity has no doubts about its own truth. So in a sense, although we may be a little more coy, a little more diplomatic in expressing, there is no question we also believe we have a truth. But coming back to Paul's question, I don't want to duck it, I think there is an example already, for example, in this country. Take the example of the Catholic Church. There is something called the Holy Will, the Sacerdota, which grants annulments to marriages which have taken place in this country to Catholics on the basis of its own rules and regulations. And so you could argue, how could a tribunal which sits in Rome actually have consequences of an influence on what happens in this country? Well, it does happen. It's not a perfect analogy. So similarly, it may well be that some degree of voluntary, already Muslims do abide to some extent by Sharia principles, so voluntarily. So if English law were to some extent to recognize that, I would not see anything per se objectionable, provided, and we know the Archbishop was not talking about chopping off of hands or anything like that. He was talking about matters of family. Right of family law. So per se, I would myself defend him on that one.
Thank you, Frank. Robin wanted to say something.
I'd say, first of all, that English law does actually recognise the right of, say, business people who are Muslims to have their contracts adjudicated under Sharia principles, but that is on the basis of a situation where people have actually agreed to that and signed up to an arbitration or an adjudication decision to be made valid in English law. So the agreement to arbitrate is valid. You can choose any system of rules to be your system of rules for the adjudication to take place. I think where the problem emerges, though, isn't where people are choosing. It's where, and this is what happens with a legal system, after all, where the choice is imposed upon them. In other words, they are required to deal with their disputes, say, under Sharia law. That would be something that we would be totally opposed to. And that's when you get from a situation where people are consenting to it to a situation where people are finding it imposed on them. And you simply can't have multiple legal systems operating within the same territory. It doesn't work.
Well, you know, in response to Robin's point, I think you can have multiple legal systems operating. I think historically you did. The Ottomans had the millet system, and of course Islam had a concept of multiculturalism where every community had their own law system that they could refer to. And they could choose to opt out of it if they want to and go to see the Islamic court, which according to a lot of historians, most of them actually did. And I advise you to check the history on this. It's a very fascinating situation. It's Islamic concept of multiculturalism. I only wish, I think my only lesson, I guess, the only aspect of Islam I like to bring for Britain is maybe this one aspect to solve your multiculturalism problem. You have a multiculturalism problem because some people, they believe in freedom, but they also believe in their own culture. And so based on their taboos, they will now hypocritically go against freedom and liberalism to impose their cultures on others. So I would say that the best way to deal with this is the Islamic multiculturalism. And I would, you know what, I would be very much agreeable to being to be treated as a dhimmi, if you know the Islamic concept of this word, a person under protected contract, under a British state whereby I'll be respected, whereby my livelihood will be protected, whereby I could practice my faith, I could go and worship as I please, and no one would question our women who they say, well, we believe in women's rights, women should choose, but you women, if you wear the burqa, we're going to ban it. See, this is the hypocrisy of this democracy. It is the hypocrisy of those who claim to espouse freedom and liberalism and so on. And I'm not talking about Andrew, because I know Andrew's he's consistent, Frank is consistent, but some people over there, maybe with the exception of Robin, are inconsistent. They say, we believe in democracy and freedom, but you must restrict your freedoms. Isn't it, did not Rousseau say, I hate what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it? No. Who is it? Voltaire. It's all French to me. It's all French.
Alan is bursting to get in.
I really am. Abdullah's talking nonsense, and he knows he's talking nonsense. Does it really think that a democracy is saying that everything you can do, everything you ever like? Doesn't democracy say, will you drive on the left-hand side or the right-hand side, and it can choose? We all know there have to be rules, there have to be regulations. The whole point of democracy is, can you extend that freedom as far as is reasonable? There are occasions when my freedom imposes on somebody else's, so society has to step in and says, no, you can't. So it's an old chestnut, Abdullah. Every time I debate him, he throws his run out. How can you ban something in the name of freedom? Well, actually, society does ban some things in the name of freedom. It's actually recently decided, in the name of freedom, to ban smoking. I personally don't object with it. I don't agree with it, but that's what they've decided to do. Society is able to take these views. That's what it does. It doesn't stop us being a democracy. So come on, Abdullah, let's move on from this silly point.
I think the humanist is also wanting to speak.
I think it's also worth pointing out that the burqa has not been banned. I mean, to say that there's a hypocrisy in democracy because you say you want freedom and then you ban something and you ban the burqa, I just remind you, it hasn't actually been banned, right?
Okay. Carry on.
All right. Basically, then why are we having this debate? We shouldn't have any debate on the ban. In France, they're going to have a debate on the ban of the burqa. Why have it? If you're not going to do it, then why? Where's the debate? Why debate on? Why have this voting for in Switzerland for whether people can, of their own free will and choice, with their own funds, build buildings in the shape of their pleasing? Why have this referendum? Why? It's because it offends the cultural values of a particular faction in the Western society. And this is the hypocrisy I'm talking about.
This is what we do in democracy. We debate these issues. We come up here, and I'm proposing the idea that... It's what we do. It's democracy. We debate these issues, Abdullah. And we respectfully debate. I respect you, but your views themselves are nonsense. I'm putting forward the proposition that the niqab only should not be allowed in our society. Nothing else, that's all. It's a valid proposition.
Yeah. Then should we start a debate on whether people who leave one religion should be killed then? Should we start, if I want to say, let's start this debate then, let's have this debate. People will say this is absurd, this goes against our liberal principles, right? Yes? So then why debate on these other issues which are going against liberal principles? Again, you have no philosophical basis, no basis to say that we should ban things except pure arbitrary culture. You say the niqab is preventing that woman from, I don't know, having some kind of relationship with you, and I mean it in the platonic sense, all right? But she's not physically harming you. Isn't that what freedom is about, right? The right to throw your fist ends at the beginning of my nose. Isn't that the principle that you guys are meant to believe in? If freedom means freedom to follow your culture, then every civilization from time immemorial has always had that freedom. You're free to follow our culture. If you go out of it, then you're banned. Of course, that's not freedom. That's just the same status quo as always has been since time immemorial.
But Taylor, you seem
Father, sorry, you'll have your chance in about 7 minutes' time, actually. Father Frank.
A brief one of a niqab. I was on a conference in the States a few years ago, and amongst the participants, there was a couple from South Africa, a Muslim couple, husband and wife. She was called Amina. She wore a burqa and the niqab. And even some other Muslims did not like her because they said she gives Islam a bad name, they whispered to me. In fact, she was humorous. She joked about looking like a ninja. She took a great liking to me. When we broke up, she said, "Father Frank, we'll never forget you." I felt I was having a relationship with her. I don't know what her face looked like, but I'm reminded of what Oscar Wilde said, many people have faces such as you wish to forget after you've seen them. So although certainly it is not cultural in the West to have, I do not believe that necessarily it stops you from having a relationship, a moral, spiritual relationship with a person. I don't believe that.
I think we may have drawn to perhaps a natural conclusion, unless any of the speakers... Well, or we can give more time to the floor. Yeah, okay, all right. What we'll do now then, we're going to have a very short break, so see you very shortly for your discussion.